Roxy, I wondered if we could maybe skip this episode and record it, let's say, 236 days from now.
So, like, November 6th.
If you just did that in your head, I think you should ditch this journalism thing and become a math person.
Mm-hmm. The phrase math person tells me that's probably not the right field for either of us.
Yes. We're both word persons. Yeah, I kind of want to go into hibernation, just skip the next 8 months and wake up after election day.
You and me and every American. Oh, I can't take it. Let's just skip to the credits. Jonathan, cue the outro music.
The intro music and the outro music are the same music.
Fine.
All right, let's do this for real. From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women wading through the political heckscape of New York and beyond. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallis, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
As unpleasant as it feels these days, we probably should talk about politics. It's an election year, after all.
Yes. Since we're recording this after Super Tuesday, we more or less know who our two presidential candidates are.
Big surprise.
I bet you can't guess them.
There are a few hanger-oners.
Really?
Still? Quick quiz. Can you name any of them?
Like, these are people who are still running as candidates?
Yes, they have yet to suspend their campaign. Most are third party.
I think Cornel West is still in.
I think he is.
The Kennedy.
The Kennedy. Yes. Whichever Kennedy it is. The anti-vax Kennedy.
Yes. And the, like, woo-woo lady who actually seems very nice.
Marianne Williamson.
Right.
No, yeah. She ended it February 8th.
All right. Well.
The only one I was sure of was Kennedy. Robert F. Kennedy. Right?
Mm-hmm. And he's really into weightlifting or something? Much I'm keeping up with the political news. Right. I am not.
What I know is that he didn't love the vaccines.
It's not just he didn't love the feeling of getting them. He did not love the concept of the vaccine.
I think he's, you know, more on sort of like libertarian-esque side where he doesn't want to be told mm-hmm. what to do, like told he has to get a vaccine, you know?
Yeah.
Also, there's rumors that Aaron Rodgers is going to be his running mate.
Sure.
Why wouldn't he be?
I mean, you could tell me anything. You could tell me one of the Jonas Brothers is running, and I'm like, okay.
Absolutely.
So this is all why I feel guilty saying this, but I have never really wanted to check out of politics more.
Yeah, I think it feels like a rinse repeat cycle I never wanted. We're just doing this again. Like, when do we get the new generation? When do we get the fresh ideas? And, you know, I think if you really look back at certainly Biden's presidency, I suppose Trump's too, you know, there's like a lot happened, a lot of bills were passed, but it doesn't feel like anything has happened. And I think a lot of people are in that space. And there's this weird sense that things are pretty bad right now in America, even when there's some like evidence to like the economy's good, the job market is good. We didn't go into the recession everyone predicted. But I think everybody still feels like we're not living our best lives over here. Like prices are still high. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like an emotional feeling of the reality. It's very hard to reassure people with a negative, like, hey, we didn't go into recession. Don't you feel good about that? You know, when there's still like the receipt is very high every time you go shopping, you know?
Right. It just continues to strike me that it's hard for me to feel hopeful or inspired for the future looking at the upcoming presidential election and to not feel like, I can't believe these are the two candidates we each party has put forward. Like, surely we could have done better in multiple ways.
I don't want to make it all about the age thing because I think there's more to it than that, but it doesn't feel like we're looking ahead. And part of that is the age, and part of that is because this is exactly the same race that we had to live through 4 years ago.
That was a bad time.
It was a really bad time. And I think we all thought we got through it. And I think there's fatigue of like, we're going to do this again.
Are you allowed to say how you feel about the election, just in a general way, as a journalist? Or do you have to keep your emotions at bay?
I probably shouldn't endorse a candidate.
No, that's all I'm asking. I feel like I maybe have a sense. It's Marianne Williamson. You're sad because she's no longer with us.
She suspended her campaign. I was listening to this podcast called The Run Up that the New York Times does. And they did an episode for Valentine's Day where they went to some speed dating events and they interview people who are about to go in speed dating. And they were like, do you think politics will come up during your speed dating round? And they asked a bunch of questions like, does it matter to you, the person that you might date, what their politics would be? Is it important that their political views are similar to yours? Mm-hmm. It was very clear that like no one wants to talk about politics. No one wants to bring it up, on certainly not in a speed dating round, but not even on a first date or a second date. Mm-hmm. Few people would be like, I'd probably like read some clues, but you know, they were just disinterested in that being a part of the dating relationship. But also it seemed like they were just very disinterested in general about politics. And the one thing that I would say consistently was that people would be like, it's less about who they vote for or what their political views are. I just don't want someone who's really extreme on either side. Was basically like, that was the most consistent thing I heard. But it was very eye-opening to me in a way of just like where this ranks in people's minds and in their daily lives.
Which feels like such a different emotional and psychological place than where we were 4 years ago and 8 years ago. I would describe both election years as very hot.
Like, yeah, right.
People on both sides of the aisle were incredibly engaged in political debate, in watching the political debates on TV, in hashing it out on social media, turning out for different rallies and protests. And it just felt like so many more Americans agreed there's a lot at stake here and I want to participate in some way.
Right.
It feels like a long time ago, honestly.
Well, if you put a lot into thinking that you were saving democracy 4 years ago and then you're back in exactly the same place in terms of what the fight is and who the vote is for, really? We just did this. We just rolled this boulder up a mountain and now we have to do it again? Like, what is the point, you know?
Well, we have data to back up the sense that people are pretty burnt out heading into this election year. So it's time for the most depressing data dump ever.
So the word dump is fitting this time.
I said earlier we can't use it, but this time we can.
Here are some findings according to a 2024 poll from UMass Amherst.
45% of Americans believe a Biden-Trump rematch is bad for the country.
More than 50% believe it would have been better if both Biden and Trump did not run for president.
The most common emotion expressed toward a Biden or Trump victory is disappointment followed by fear.
73% of Americans are concerned about violence associated with the 2024 election.
And a significant share of Americans believe that a victory by either Biden or Trump will threaten American democracy. Time magazine recently published this piece called The Dread Election that seemed to capture the mood well. Basically, the reporter was focusing on kind of the left of center anti-Trump resistance. She argued that the resistance era is over. Like, all the zeal that brought out voters to resist former President Trump has dwindled. Even traffic on like political news sites has dropped. Fewer people are tuning into political coverage on TV. And I think at least for that resistance movement, there's a sense that obviously this doesn't really matter. We didn't prevent this man from moving ahead to a new presidential race. So what's the point?
So one of the things that seems to be happening now that I've read a little bit about and heard some people talk about is that there's this phrase, right, like kitchen table issues, and that's usually what drives people to vote. It's the economy, stupid.
Wow, I'm sorry, I didn't know.
Quote unquote. The maxim is, right, in the end, it's the economy. In the end, people care about the price of groceries and the price of gas. That's what drives their vote. And it's really a very practical way of approaching the ballot box. What has seemed to happen over the last, I don't know, decade, maybe 8 years, has been that the culture war issues have become more and more the order of the day. Like, people are actually voting for those issues. And the economy still matters, but it's lost some of its power in people's political calculations. And I wonder about that. I wonder about how that's shaping our politics, how that's shaping our society. You know, I think when you think about big national elections, it can be one thing to talk about these giant cultural issues like abortion or trans rights or gun control. But when you look at more local elections and stuff, I think that, you know, that's when you kind of still get some of the more practical like issues. But even those, like school board elections, have been taken over by these culture war issues. And I can't help but think that that's not good for us. Like, the soul of the nation. That's not good for us.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me that if a majority of Americans are voting on kitchen table issues, like the issues that most directly affect their family's well-being, that's something that people from across the political aisle can kind of agree on. Like, everybody wants lower prices at the grocery store. Everybody wants good mortgage rates.
Yes.
You can have very deeply held beliefs about issues around morality and sexuality and all the big issues. But at the end of the day, like, you and your neighbor agree, yeah, like the prices at the grocery store really high, it'd be great to see those go down. What can we do in terms? Yeah. The culture war issues feel, they actually feel less like voting for actual policy changes and more about voting for one's identity.
Yeah.
Like, I want someone in the White House who agrees with me that this is really wrong, whether or not they can actually affect any policy-oriented change on this specific issue. It's just that I want someone who has the same moral convictions that I do, especially somebody who agrees with me that the people on the other side of this issue are not just wrong, but like bad. Like, they're bad people. Yeah. They're evil people.
It's that kind of discourse, I think, that puts politics in the wrong place. Like, it's no longer in its rightful place. It's become religion. It's become something that is that is taking the place of a morality structure and saying that the government should be imposing that and should be dictating that. And I suppose that's maybe the definition of an idol.
Yeah, I feel like penultimate things taking the place of an ultimate thing, pretty standard definition of an idol. I said earlier that I kind of felt guilty about checking out of politics, and I do. But I will say, when I was most engaged in, and when I say engaged in politics, what I mean to say is I was most engaged on the internet debating things or posting things to Instagram. That had been my conception of political engagement. I can look back and remember how I didn't like how it was shaping me, how that kind of engagement was shaping my attitude and posture toward other people. And I'm not saying these issues don't matter. And I'm not saying that we should never debate these things because we should all just get along. Like, I'm all for actual conversation about things that matter. But the ways that we have gone about this or our models of political engagement feel just kind of gross, you know? And I didn't like how it was shaping how I was thinking about other people who I really disagreed with.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my grandparents fighting about politics. They were part of opposite parties. But it's so much more divisive now, or it feels that way to me. And it feels like even being friends with, let alone partnered with, someone of the opposite political party, like, oh my gosh, that's tantamount to like sleeping with the enemy, you know? I mean, this is the enemy. And so I think that kind of extreme political posturing and the whole country living that way, this is not good. This is dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why almost three quarters of the people surveyed in the previous poll were worried that there would be some kind of violence as a result of the election. People are so angry at each other. And we have seen violence erupt as a result of an election on January 6th at the Capitol. Like, there is a very recent precedent for this spilling over into violent actions.
We have become, as a country, as people, as Christians, it seems very malformed by our political moment. And that's part of why we wanted to talk to our guest today, Michael Ware, who has long been thinking about the ways that politics and faith intersect.
Michael started his career as a White House staffer under President Obama and is now the founder and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. He's the author of the new book, The Spirit of Our Politics, and one of the few people today who's modeling political engagement well in a hot take time.
Our interview with Michael is coming up. But first, let's give a shout out to the organization that makes this all possible. Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
If you want to know how faith and spirituality are factoring into the election, be sure to follow RNS coverage at religionnews.com.
We've gotten some new love for the Apocryphon series that Tyler Huckabee and I hosted this winter. One person wrote in and said, "So glad to hear the Apocryphon reading series will become a regular feature. Really insightful look at some books I'd rather forget, LOL. Pairs perfectly with the regularly scheduled Saved by the City episodes, which I listen to every week. Eager for more."
This listener is in luck. We're currently planning more Apocryphon episodes with Tyler. And if you like what else we're doing, drop us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts or shoot us an email at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com. Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're really excited today to be joined by an old friend, Michael Ware, who has also just released a new book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Hi, so good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
In case you didn't know, or any listeners didn't know, it's an election year, a presidential election year. Yay! But yeah, that's not what anybody thinks. Nobody thinks yay. The one thing everybody can agree on is that nobody's excited about this election. And everybody kind of agrees something's broken in our politics. Generally, people kind of feel despair when they think about this election. They're tired. They feel hopeless in some ways. Our politics over the last 8 years has really worn people down, it seems. Michael, you talk about this kind of political sickness in your book. What do you believe is going on here?
Yeah, a lot is going on, right? And so at the end of the day, that our politics can't get around the kind of people we are. Mm. And we can point at the quote unquote bums at our state capitals or in the Beltway, or we could complain that the system isn't what it should be. And that's true. But the system emerged at some fundamental sense out of the will of the people. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that we dig into some of the issues that are so disturbing about our politics, the more we realize that things are the way they are, again, in a fundamental sense, because of the way that we are. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the bad news. Mm. The good news is that we can become a different kind of people, that we could change the incentive structure that we offer to our politics. This book is about the tie between spiritual formation and civic renewal and the health of our public life.
I imagine a lot of listeners, myself included, have never felt more tempted to kind of check out of national politics, at least. Yeah. Like, there is this sickness. People are terrible to each other. There are all these systemic issues. I'm going to stay above the fray, take responsibility for what I can and let everything else go. And I think probably a lot of Christian leaders in particular feel like, I don't want to get involved because I serve this broad constituency. And if I speak about political issues or care about political issues, I'll be seen as divisive. Why is it important to stay engaged?
Part of the political sickness, something called political sectarianism, which is a framework of thinking about the kind of polarization we have today. And what I like about this framework, I like many things about this framework. One of the things that it avoids is the really unproductive debate of, is polarization worse now than ever before? Mm-hmm. And then the rabbit hole of like, well, the Civil War seemed pretty bad. Like, you know, this framework is just about assessing the kind of polarization we have today. Like, what are we facing today? And political sectarianism is upheld by three pillars, or contains three ingredients, primary ingredients. Aversion, which is the tendency to dislike or distrust one's political opponent, the tendency to other those who are politically different, and then the tendency of moralization, or I use the term misplaced moralization, which is the tendency to elevate political difference from disagreement to the level of iniquity, to good and evil. This toxic cocktail has disastrous effects for governance. It also is affecting how we relate to one another. This stuff doesn't stay contained to politics proper. Like, this doesn't stay contained to discussions on C-SPAN with elected officials. As I talk with pastors around the country, it's apparent that politics produces culture that is affecting our families, our churches, our communities in a way that's really unavoidable and that we need to contend with and address. What I do want to affirm in your question is, like, stepping back from national politics, particularly like certain people's like conception of national politics, I think there is like an unhealthy, this political scientist, Eitan Hersh, calls it political hobbyism. Mm-hmm. A political hobbyist is someone who is like consumed with the entertainment of politics.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They could describe to you every up and down of Trump's indictments and different gossipy sort of stories. But the one thing they're never doing really is power building. They're never actually participating mm-hmm. in the work of politics. And yet if you ask them, like, is politics burning you out? They'd be like, oh, yes.
Right.
And what they mean by that is like, you know, I'm listening to 4 hours of podcasts and man, I'm really like in this intense back and forth on Reddit. And as Hirsch describes, the kinds of skills and disposition that you build up through that sort of consumption and participation in political entertainment mm-hmm. actually forms you away from what it actually takes to participate in politics constructively. And so caring about your neighbor doesn't necessarily look like watching MSNBC or Fox News 3 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So people can relieve themselves of that burden, but there is a rightly sized burden, responsibility that we have as citizens and then as Christians to be attentive to the ways that political decisions impact our neighbors. And that's why we care about politics.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about why you said as citizens and as Christians, this is part of our responsibility. Is there a particular reason Christians especially should care? Because I think a lot of people right now might argue that Christians have gotten a little too involved in politics. You even write in the book that the crisis is not that Christians are politically homeless right now, but that they ever thought they could make their home in politics at all. You know, we've really seen that marriage of politics and Christianity in unhealthy ways. So talk a little bit about like, why should Christians get engaged when in a lot of ways it feels like, hey, church and state, separation here, you know?
Yeah. I think some Christians have long argued for a special status in American politics while avoiding a special responsibility.
Mm. I'm just going to be snapping and amening throughout this.
So there is a long history of this sort of wizened Christian politicos calling for a political withdrawal because what they saw like wasn't great. Mm. This book is very much an application of Dallas Willard's ideas to politics and public life. And we could talk more about Dallas, but very briefly, Dallas was a philosopher, taught at USC for almost 50 years, was also a Christian teacher and author. Dallas argued the gospel is about Jesus's announcement of the present availability of the kingdom of God for those who would walk into it. If you are a citizen in this country and any other sort of democratic society, you do not choose to have political influence. You already have it. The decision to make is how to faithfully steward the responsibility and influence you already have. And so I was told this directly. The church needs to put its own house in order, and then we can be of some good to the public. And I don't think it works that way. The luxury of seeking to quarantine off politics or the social aspects of our lives so that we could sort of get our own hearts right and then we'll be... No, you actually grow seeking to follow Jesus wherever he has placed you as part of your life. Pre-religious right, this was the approach of evangelicals. And then something happened in the culture. And if you listen, you know, Randall Balmer would argue it's the civil rights movement. The religious right themselves would say it was sort of Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. What happens is like something happens. And then even if you were apathetic and withdrawn, then all of a sudden you're thrust in, but you don't have any muscles for it. And you're motivated by what fears you have and what angers you have. So it never gets around to being other-centered, a willing of the good in our politics.
Let's talk a little bit more about a generation of evangelicals during and post-religious right. Are we post-religious right? Probably not.
I don't know what we
Well, I don't know, Caitlin. Apparently, Christian nationalism is this new fad that just emerged.
The buzzword.
So a whole generation of evangelicals who have been deeply influenced by the posture and the goals of the religious right perhaps are now saying, wow, this movement has brought very bad fruit. I don't want to be formed spiritually as a person, as a disciple by those narratives.
what does healthy spiritual formation for the good work of politics look like?
Yeah, I mean, this is a profound question. So
this is the book.
Yeah. I open the book with a story. A friend of mine who is a longtime religious right activist also does international religious freedom work and human rights work. And we've worked together on those issues for a long time. She calls me. And usually when she's calling, it's like there's a human rights crisis in a country, like we need to sign a petition or whatever. Mm-hmm. This time she goes, Michael, I know this is out of the blue, but I have a daughter. She's in college. She's stopped going to church with our family. She is saying she doesn't know if she's a Christian any longer. She doesn't see how the values I raised her with, she doesn't see how that comports with my work and my politics, and in this case, my support for Trump. I would like for her to spend time with you. I want her to spend time with a small O Orthodox Christian who just has a different approach to politics than her parent. And then this is the line that got me. She said, Michael, I no longer care about the future of my daughter's politics. I just want her to start going to church with her family again. And that to me was one of the saddest conversations I've had, but also like one of the most hopeful, which is to say when I go to Christian colleges, when I talk with young people, so many people are waiting for someone in their life to tell them that. To tell them I would be okay losing on my political ambitions. I would be okay not making my point if it meant you might draw nearer to Jesus. And one of the problems is just we have a culture which that is penalized, where to be a Christian of conviction, you can't let people off the hook of their wrong political views that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so much of what people are rejecting. This idea that what it means to be a Christian in politics is to have the quote unquote right answer on two or three issues. And you could advance those positions in the most destructive, manipulative, malicious way. But so long as you have the right answer, then you're like on the good side and everybody else is on the bad side. The realization I came to that I was quite embarrassed about that it took me this long to connect these dots, just because I've been, you know, I've worked in politics for 15 years and been a Christian for longer. Dallas Willard describes Gospels of Sin Management. He says that theology has developed in such a way in the West that in some circles, you can have the worst kind of character possible. But so long as you provide mental assent to a few lines of doctrine, so long as you subscribe to the right theory of atonement, then you'll end up in the good place and everyone else will end up in the bad place. And he says this is developed to the extent that, as is widely discussed, you cannot say anything categorical about the character of a Christian as compared to the character of someone who is not a Christian. Mm-hmm. The two things are connected. Mm-hmm. It is not a surprise that a gospel that suggests that what it means to be a Christian is about having the right set of answers to a series of doctrinal questions. It's not a surprise that that translates over to politics in a similar way. And I think that's what people are rightly sort of rejecting, this idea that the direction of our politics can be so detached from the character of the engagement, from the actual orientation of the heart. And that should be rejected.
Going back a little bit, you mentioned something about Christians got engaged in politics without the muscles. What are those muscles that you're thinking about that would help Christians contribute to politics in a less malformed way?
So there are a lot of ways to talk about this. I mean, Colossians 3 is really helpful. Fruit of the Spirit is a way to talk about this. So there's a chapter in my book on gentleness. I think that it can sound interesting to people or like kind of squishy to talk about love and politics or hope and politics. But you talk about gentleness and politics and like people like switch off. And yet we have this really significant problem, which is that the New Testament tells us, the scripture tells us, and Jesus lived it, that gentleness is not an optional. There's an overestimation of the value of anger. I mean, right, it's a trope. If you're not angry, you're not paying attention.
Right.
No,
right.
It's if you're not angry on Twitter, you're not paying attention.
That's exactly right.
If you're not angry and letting other people know you're angry,
yes,
you are on the side of the oppressor. I just want to make that really clear.
As if the performance and expression of anger is what those suffering injustice are looking for.
Thank you for your Instagram post.
Yeah.
Meanwhile.
That's a harmful idea. I think there are better responses than the cultivation of anger. But our politics suggests that we can direct anger for our purposes. Mm-hmm. And we valorize anger. So, I mean, Trump has just done a number on folks. They try to dissect, well, Trump is successful. What are the qualities of Trump? He doesn't talk like politicians usually talk. So we've seen this with like Beto O'Rourke and some political strategists, which is like, you know, the reason why Democrats are not connecting with the people is they're not using the language of the people. If we use more vulgarity, then people would understand how much we really cared about this stuff. Mm. Mm-hmm.
You are one of the most winsome kind of public figures addressing politics that I know. There's a very Tim Keller, Dallas Willard-esque tone that reminds us of like how hopeful we were when we were young millennials in 2008. And wow, that feels like a long time ago.
Wow, it does.
And because of all that's transpired since that time, there's even this question, even in Christian circles, about Tim Keller's winsome approach. Well, that's squishy.
Naive.
Yeah. That might have worked 20 years ago, but the culture wars are raging such that we have to basically forsake gentleness in order to get the job done.
Yeah.
Are we past the days of needing to be winsome Christians in the public square?
How convenient that under the banner of Christianity, you advance the most belligerent, antisocial, antagonistic politics. And then you justify that politics based on a public perception that Christians are belligerent and antisocial and don't care about the common good. It's a negative world out there and we need to destroy it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I don't say that for everyone involved in the conversation. And I just really want to be clear. I think James Woods' article, mm-hmm. I think it was ill-timed. I think it was ill-conceived.
Just really quickly, James Wood was writing an essay critiquing Keller's winsomeness framework, not long before he died, but certainly after Keller had been diagnosed with cancer and it was terminal.
And I think James has a lot of important things to say. I consider him to be a friend and a conversation partner. And there are others that are having conversation, sort of the post-liberal conversation, I think, has something important to say. So I'm not talking about that. I am talking about those who are political actors mm-hmm. who will go to churches and say in churches, look, this love your enemy stuff.
Right.
Maybe try that in your personal life. But if you try that in politics, you'll get run over.
Right. You can't act like Christ in politics.
But here's the thing that bugs me about the left. The left wants us to say that that's Christian nationalism. And I'm like, mm-hmm. why would I label something Christian anything when it's explicitly arguing that the way of Jesus doesn't hold up in the nation, in our politics?
Mm. Ooh, good point.
Interesting.
You know, T.S. Eliot said, the human endeavor has been to try to create a system so perfect that people no longer have to be good. Mm. That is the primary political and technological conceit, that we can uh-huh. somehow get to a more moral society or a more just and ordered society that will impose on us and do the work of becoming the kind of people who could support such a society, who would mm-hmm. actually will it to be. And that's just not going to happen. So this book is about the centrality of spiritual formation to civic renewal. And what mm-hmm. I'm hoping to do is empower Christians to place their politics and their political life as opposed to outside of the gospel or above the gospel, as opposed to idolatry or apathy, to feel like their political life and to act and think as though their political life is part of the life they're living with Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I have supreme confidence, separate from any particular political ends or who's going to win this election. Mm-hmm. I am willing to place my confidence in people drawing near to Jesus and the social, political, all the consequences of that being in a more productive direction than what we have now.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was great
to
have you.
So good to be with you. Yeah.
Thank you for getting blunt.
Yes, thank you for being
blunt. It was fun when that happened. Unfortunately, we can't actually hibernate for the next 8 months, even though I requested that at the beginning of the episode, and nor should we. You have to stay engaged for your job.
True.
But what are a few things we could do to engage politics better moving forward?
Well, I did feel really called out by Michael when he said that listening to a lot of podcasts is not actually political engagement. So sorry, everybody, you can't check that off your list after listening to this podcast. Yeah. I do listen to a lot of political podcasts.
Are you like a political news junkie?
I think I might have turned into one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should sprinkle in some more edifying podcasts in between.
Like ours.
Like ours. Maybe something from like the Cooking Channel or something. How to do it better. I mean, I do feel, I think we've talked about this before, like I think it would be a good practice for me this year to like really pay more attention to what's happening in my own city, mm-hmm. not just my city, but like the neighborhood I live in, the things that are really going to impact the people that are my neighbors.
Yeah.
And not just fixate on like the national election and like the newest poll that comes out every 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's really good. That's something that I felt called out by Michael on, that where you can actually affect the most change is probably at the local level. And the more that we can bring politics down to the level of where we live our embodied lives, the healthier we'll probably be.
I think I've already started to talk about it less. And maybe this is part of the aforementioned like disengagement. I'm just part of that trend. But I feel like I don't feel compelled to infuse conversations with politics in the way that I have maybe in a couple of years ago.
So these are all the things we're not doing. I think also remembering that politics, especially national politics, is not the only way to affect change in the world. Like there really are things that faith communities or neighborhoods or civic organizations can do probably more effectively than what a national leader who's far removed from the actual issues on the ground can do. It's not like our only options are national politics or the individual. There are all these mediating organizations and institutions that can do a lot of good as it pertains to like ensuring other people's well-being.
Well, and I think paying attention to what they're asking for their constituents to do is helpful too. You know, a lot of these organizations will be like, please call your congressperson about this specific thing right now because this is affecting our funding this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's a way to engage in politics that probably can feel a little more personal and also a little more practical.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of political decisions really do affect a lot of groups and a lot of organizations, but they, you know, they go under the radar so much of the time.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like we should ask for like our listeners to contact their congressperson to increase funding for nonprofit journalism. I don't know if that's a thing, but if it was, y'all should do it.
You should, yes. Or just donate to RNS. Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward. The consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look, and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone.
And Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening. If you made it that far. It does feel a little Sisyphean. How do you say that as an adjective?
Sisyphus-like.